This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, say to language, "Whoa, hey, slow down. I think we might be better off just staying friends." Recent episodes were about people getting together. This episode is about people splitting up. It's not particularly saucy, but there are adult themes and a couple of Category B swear words. Let's prepare ourselves with a little word history. Here's the etymology of fornication, a term for sex which has always carried a suggestion of immorality. It arrived in English from French by the 14th century, but came from the Latin fornix, which referred to brothels. Brothel, by the way, comes from the Old English word for degenerate or decay. But fornix originally meant an arch or a vaulted chamber, so why that connection? It's thought that the ancient Roman sex workers may have stood in arches waiting for trade. While fornix gained a sexual connotation, skullduggery, originally a synonym for fornication, has lost its, and now it's just a term for underhand behaviour. Other fun old terms for fornication include jollity and abandon. But in the Old Testament, fornication also meant idolatry, cheating on God with other objects of worship. Furthermore, idolatry appears as one of the definitions of adultery. Again, there's that sense of spiritual infidelity. Surprisingly, adultery is not related to the word adult, which is from the Latin for grown, but it shares origins with adulterate from the Latin for mixed, because adulterers had adulterated the marriage by mixing themselves sexually with someone other than the person to whom they were married. In the McLennan vs. McLennan divorce case in 1958, proof of adultery required physical contact with an alien and unlawful organ, which wording conjures a very colourful variety of possibilities. We'll be coming back to the meaning of adultery later in the show. Just before we get to it, bear in mind, a lot of this episode is about the complexities of the British legal system, which has certain processes and eccentricities that other countries' legal systems might not have. If you're outside of the UK, remember, ours is a system that requires staff to wear wigs and capes to work, even though they're not superheroes. So if you're thinking that a fact in this show sounds a little odd, just go with it. Strap yourself into the roller coaster, throw your hands in the air, and scream into the wind. On with the show. A little while ago, I asked you to tell me about the worst things you've said to break up with someone or that they said to you.
I once had a guy break up with me by saying, "I no longer feel comfortable accepting your love."
The worst thing I said to someone to break up with them, I called him and said that we are breaking up. You have no say in the matter. You cannot say anything that will change my mind. I am going to hang up in 20 minutes. You can say your bit until then, but no matter what you say, I will hang up in 20 minutes. And that was how I broke up with him. And I still hear from my friends, even today, that that was probably one of the meanest things I've ever done. But it was very necessary, because he's the kind of person to hang on and to cling if he thinks he has any hope.
I feel like a jerk even sharing this. Like, it actually makes me uncomfortable to share this. I apparently said something pretty awful to a girl when I was in high school. We had kind of liked each other for about a year, and then we went to a school dance, and we kissed. And I got way in my head afterwards, which is a pattern that has apparently haunted me ever since. And I just started second-guessing it, and for whatever reason decided, like, oh, we can't see each other. Complete neuroses took over. Anyway, so I approach her and I tell her that you're great and I like you and let's be friends. And apparently one of the things that I said in the obligatory breakup speech, in my attempt to sort of put it gently, was, "I tried to like you. Let's just peel the layers back on that." Because what that means is, one, you are effort to like. Two, I put that effort into it. I gave it the old try. And so I'm like trying to paint myself as a nice guy when really this is an obnoxious statement that I should not have said. And then three, I just was not able to overcome the challenges of liking you. Now, she was a wonderful girl. She was really pretty. She was really smart, really funny, really, like, she was a catch. And apparently that just, like, devastated her. I feel terrible about that. I feel a great amount of guilt about that statement, because I think if I had said that to an adult, that would be sort of a lousy thing to say to somebody. But whatever gets said to you at that age just puts a dent in you. Anyway, that's this super lousy, shitty thing that I said to somebody in an attempt to be nice. I was a complete dick. And I feel bad about it now, in this moment, in sharing this with you, Helen.
When it comes to breakups, language fails not just at the point one is taking place.
I actually bemoan the lack of language to describe any types of relationships.
That's Rosie Wilby. She's a comedian who has spent the last several years writing about relationships, monogamy, polyamory, sex and breakups.
The term breakup, it sounds emotionally violent.
And it sounds irreparable as well, a breakup.
It does, doesn't it? It sounds awful.
Like you could never commute it into a healthy, different style of relationship.
No, I think people have, but maybe they wouldn't say broken up. Would they say separated or split up? I think people try and use slightly different words, but they'd still sound final, don't they?
In March 2014, the term conscious uncoupling entered the breakup lexicon when Gwyneth Paltrow used it to announce the end of her marriage to Coldplay's Chris Martin. The phrase was coined around 2009 by the psychotherapist Catherine Woodward Thomas when she and her husband were getting unmarried. Yes, they were divorcing, but they wanted cordial terms that would reflect how they would remain part of each other's lives and families.
Perhaps I'm being idealistic, but I've always thought it's really important to try and have that different phase to the relationship. And post-romantic is one way I've thought of describing it.
Or what the noun would be.
Oh, that's my... Yes, that doesn't make sense, does it? That's my post-romantic person. Yes, that's
post-partner.
My... Post-partner. That sounds like you go around delivering letters together or something, doesn't it?
But even when a relationship ends in a way that isn't so much post-romantic as a maelstrom of bitterness and anger, the post-partners don't necessarily have an easy job finding the right labels for each other. Nick Allen is a divorce lawyer, and in nearly 20 years of the job, he's heard exes refer to each other in terms from the profane to the, well, nothingy.
They often don't refer to their spouse by name at all. They'll almost just find ways of constructing a sentence. Have they arrived yet? Has he arrived yet? Will I see him in court? Do I have to sit opposite her? So there is a lot of him or her, and often very little use of names.
Do they not want to call them by name because they don't really want to acknowledge that they're there, or because they're trying to dehumanise them, or what?
I think it could be both. And I think it may be different in different situations. But if people are trying to be less emotional about it, saying, has he arrived, may be easier on them than saying, has David arrived?
What about terms like ex?
They tend not to use ex. Sometimes they will use mother or father to describe the other party. But it's probably first names if they want to be nice about each other, or no names at all.
My husband and I were married for 7 years. He finally told me that no, he didn't want to continue our marriage, that he indeed did want a divorce. And when I pressed him to give me a real reason, what he came up with was that he ran out of emotional equity. So yes, now I'm getting divorced because he ran out of emotional equity.
How much a part does semantics play in the law?
I'd like to say that semantics doesn't play any part at all, but I think so much of our time is focusing on what does a word mean? Is there a reason why it's in a singular form? Should it be in a plural form? I mean, in the matrimonial statute, which governs the dissolution of financial claims, you have words that the courts give meanings to, such as needs. What does needs mean? These are the words that Parliament sets out, but we as lawyers then sort of impress upon that our own meaning, if you like, because one person says they need £100,000 a year to live. Other people, well, 99% of the population would say, come off it. That's not a need to need £100,000 to live on a year. That's a wish list. But it's amazing how we stand up in court and say somebody needs X or needs Y, because that's the word in the statute. But to any normal person in the street, if you'd say somebody needs that, they'd look at you as if you were mad.
I once told a woman I was dating that I needed to break up with her because she wasn't broken enough. And I feel like a real shithead about it.
But another good word is contributions that the parties to the marriage have made. Now, again, what does contributions mean? Until 2000, when the law fundamentally changed, when the House of Lords said we'd been doing it wrongly for 27-odd years.
What had you been doing?
Well, what had we been doing? We had been... Well, the House of Lords told us that we had not been valuing the contribution of the homemaker the same as the contribution of the breadwinner.
Oh, right, so you hadn't been treating it as a job...
We had not been treating them as equal. Mm-hmm. And effectively, if there was, I'm going to make up a figure, if there was £10 million to divide and the wife's needs were met for the rest of her life with £1 million, the husband would walk away with £9 million. Mm-hmm. And in 2000, the House of Lords came up with this lovely phrase called the yardstick of equality, which said that you have to come up with good reasons to depart from equality. But if there aren't any good reasons to depart from equality, given that the role of the homemaker and the role of the breadwinner has to be treated equally, then on that example, both parties would come away with £5 million each. And most people, including me, would think that's a lot fairer.
A boyfriend in college broke up with me, and I quote, because you just aren't pretty enough. How's that for bad?
I ended my first serious relationship with a girl with the words, I hate myself when I'm with you.
But we have other great words, like if people are trying to say that one party has dissipated money that should then be added back, the conduct to add it back has to be wanton or reckless. You know, I'm not sure I've ever heard the word wanton in normal speech ever. But one judge uses the phrase, there has to be wanton or reckless expenditure. And then barristers and solicitors up and down the land are standing up in court saying this particular expenditure is wanton and reckless, or this particular expenditure is not wanton and reckless. But it's just phrases that come from the law reports that, you know, we all start imbuing with this huge amount of significance.
And the phrases are like 19th century bodice rippers.
30 years ago, a woman author broke up with me. When I asked her why it didn't work out, she answered, I don't know, maybe if you'd read more Kafka. That was at once one of the worst and funniest breakup moments of my life.
I asked her over instant message if she wanted to go out with me. Her response was, not really, sorry. Only she forgot the comma.
Here in the UK, there is a complicated situation regarding same-sex marriage. In brief, the Civil Partnership Act of 2004 allowed same-sex couples to marry for the first time. The ceremony and the legal significance were very similar to a heterosexual civil marriage. Only the government decided it had to stay distinct from marriage, and thus it was called civil partnership, not marriage. Then, same-sex marriage was legalised in 2013, but it isn't quite the same as civil partnership. For one, the vocabulary is different.
When the Civil Partnership Act was passed, the Labour government was very clear that they were creating an institution that was completely separate to that of marriage and divorce. So they had to come up with a different term for divorce, so they came up with dissolution.
And is there any difference between a dissolution and a divorce?
Absolutely no difference at all, although adultery is not a ground to dissolve a civil partnership.
Really?
But apart from that, the grounds of divorce and dissolution are identical.
Adultery is grounds for a same-sex married couple to get a divorce because the terms of same-sex marriage match those of heterosexual marriage.
But given that probably the government didn't really want to have a debate in the House of Lords explaining how same-sex relationships might work, the wheeze they came up with, having not had adultery in civil partnership, they said, well, we have to have adultery, so because marriage is marriage, but it's still only going to be adultery with someone of the opposite sex. They didn't want to grapple with the change, the definition of adultery, because adultery is sexual intercourse with someone of the opposite sex, and I believe, without going into too much detail, talks about degrees of penetration. The government thought we have to use adultery, but not to redefine it.
Evidently, the government does have to redefine the legal meaning of adultery, unless they really are capable of hiding from reality forever. Can someone send them some diagrams? Maybe some educational dolls?
I once went out with a guy who said he needed some more time. I bought him some, the herb, left it in a packet on his desk. Not sure that's quite what he meant. Never heard from him again.
She said, I really like you and all, but I think I need to spend more time with my horse.
Oh, who hasn't lost out to a horse? You can find out about Rosie Wilby's gigs, writing, radio shows and podcasts at rosiewilby.com. And let's hope you don't need Nick Allen's services. Before we call this whole thing off, your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is quadruminous, adjective, zoology, dated, of primates having all 4 feet modified as hands, i.e. having opposable digits. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with editorial help from Hrishikesh Hirway from Song Exploder. Martin Austwick made the music. Very big thanks to the listeners who shared their breakup stories. I hope it was cathartic in some way. But let's stay together, listeners, at Facebook and Twitter / Allusionist Show and at theallusionist.org.